This week's episode is brought to you by Groenfell Meadery, an open-source meadery. Head over to groenfell.com, that's groenfell.com, to try their recipes at home. Or order mead right to your door at groenfell.com/store. That's groenfell. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 13th, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we'll hear about a collaboration of Hyrick House Museum and Ancho Cider in Washington, D.C., as they revive a Prohibition-era cider that started off as non-alcoholic, then got a mind of its own. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. One of the projects that we're working on that subscribers will see first is a video episode of my sizer that I made with local honey. I talked about it a couple weeks ago. I got the inspiration from a recipe on the Groenfell Meadery website for their Chaos Sizer. And I told Ricky the Meadmaker that I was making this, and he says that they are planning to bring this sizer back into production. It's apparently been out of production for 5 years, and I wasn't aware of that. So, Chaos Sizer fans, stay tuned. Anyway, I deviated from the recipe a bit, as I am wont to do. I used 3 pounds, or 1.4 kilograms of local honey, 2 quarts, or 1.9 liters of apple juice, and a total of 1.5 gallons, or 5.7 liters of water. This is for about a 2-2.5 gallon batch. And I heated the water up a little bit for easier mixing. And to that, to all those ingredients, I added 1 packet of Fleischmann's Active Dry Yeast that I hydrated. I also added 1 teaspoon of yeast nutrient to start. And the bread yeast took off pretty much right away. The next day, I added another 1/2 teaspoon of nutrient with another 1/2 teaspoon the day after that. Degassing along the way by swirling the fermenter. You want to do that before you add the nutrient, unless you like the Mentos trick. in that case, we'll hear from you on the Disaster Show episode. Anyway, the fermentation was complete a week later. It was done. It went from 1054, I believe, was the starting gravity, went down to a 0.998. I bottled and primed on the eighth day. On the eighth day, I bottled the sizer. I also split the batch and added some vanilla extract to a part of it. The recipe calls for vanilla extract, and I bottled 7 plain and then added the vanilla extract to the rest of it. It's only been a few days, but I couldn't resist. And yesterday, I opened one, and it gave a little bit of a hiss when I opened it, so it's got a ways to go. It's not fully carbonated yet, but it tastes delicious. So, all that to say, just look for that on a future video episode. Excited about that. Let's talk about our friends and sponsors at Tavor. If you listen to the show, you know about Tavor. It's a way to select delicious craft beers that you may not be able to find in your area and have them delivered to you. It's not a Beer of the Month club where somebody else chooses the beer for you and it's just a surprise when it comes to the door. You only pay for the beer that you choose over the course of the month. Signing up for Tavor is free. Just create an account at Tavor.com. That's TAVOUR.com and download their iPhone or Android app. You'll receive notifications for 2 new beers each day that are available for purchase with in-depth tasting notes from Philip at Tavor. This month, look for selections from Stick City, E9, Cider Boys, Forest and Main, Arvon, and Casita. If you're not interested in the beers that you see on the app or on the website, no worries, just skip the ones that you don't want. However, when you do see something that you do want, and you will, don't wait, just click on it to get it and add it to your crate, and your beer arrives fresh every few weeks, allowing you enough time to fill a box and pay the least shipping. So why don't you check it out? It doesn't cost anything to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase anything. In fact, if I can ask you a favor, go to Tavor.com, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com, or download the app, and when you sign up, enter the promo code BASICBREWING, all one word, and you'll get $10 off your first shipment of $25 or more. Again, it's free to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase. Sign up at Tavor.com or with the app and enter Basic Brewing as the promo code. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Tom writes in with this: I made up a drinking game around your videos. Normally we don't approve of drinking games. We don't promote drinking games, you know, because, you know, you just drink at your own pace. But, you know, it's kind of fun to see the rules that Tom made up. So here are the rules to the Basic Brewing YouTube video drinking game. Number one, how long does it take before a dad joke was said? Take a sip for each minute before it happens. Well, you're probably pretty safe on that one. There's going to be a dad joke pretty quick. Number two, take a sip for each mention of Steve's Brewshop.com. It must have the pause in between. Well, you'll get one sip, like at least one sip per show. Did James chuckle? Take a sip. Well, that's... See? That's a dangerous one right there. Finish your drink when Steve mentions bouquet when describing the beer. I'll have to listen for that one. And finish your drink for every pop culture reference up to and including 1967. Well, that's another dangerous one. So thanks for that, Tom. I shy away from recommending drinking games, as I say, especially because I think you'd get snockered if you did the chuckling rule. I think you'd be on the floor by the end of the episode. But Tom continues. Tom says, the real reason why I was writing today was to ask a question about no-chill brewing. I've only done it 3 times in the 100 or so batches I've made. Recently, I made a beer from a kit. I had a chance to drink it back-to-back with this exact same kit someone else made. My other variable besides the no-chill was that I boiled for 15 minutes while adjusting for bitterness with a larger hop charge. My beer came out far more bitter than the other. Have you ever experienced your no-chill beers tend to be more bitter than similar beers chilled with your wort chiller? Well, here's what I wrote to Tom. I said, I haven't noticed my no-chill beers being more bitter than my chilled ones. I think one reason is that I only do no-chill with beers that pretty much don't have hops added at the end of the boil. And they've been through a standard 60-minute boil time. So theoretically, the hops that are in there have gotten most of the isomerization done to them already. So I think that Tom can credit his larger hop charge for the difference. The 15-minute boil is meant to get more hop flavor and aroma at the expense of bitterness extraction, because you're cutting that off, you know, by chilling only after 15 minutes. So when the wort remained hot in the no-chill container, that isomerization continued like it was a longer boil. So I think that's what's happening. So when I'm doing a short boil with lots of hops for, say, a New England IPA style beer, I always chill just to keep that bitterness in balance and to preserve those hop flavors and aromas. So there you go. And when I brew full-size batches of my beers, both chilled and non-chilled, I use my electric brew-in-a-bag system from our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. Desiree and Dave have been designing and building electric systems, since when it seemed very non-conventional. But nowadays, brewers everywhere are realizing that electric brewing is the way to take the pain out of propane. The Warthog systems you find at highgravitybrew.com are fun and easy to use, and you can find one to fit your brewing style. Whether you're a single-vessel brewer like me, or if you want 2 or 3 vessels in the more traditional style, from 5 gallons to 2 barrels, highgravitybrew.com has you covered. I love my Warthog controller, as you know. Using the mash mode, the system brings the strike water up to temperature and holds it there through the whole mash rest. No more worrying about wrapping mash tuns in blankets and towels, especially in the wintertime. And the boil mode holds a nice rolling boil at the rate I like without my having to worry about the wind or running out of propane. And at highgravitybrew.com, you can find other manufacturers' systems, too. So check it all out at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric gear purchase. And don't forget the Build Your Own Beer page as well. That's at highgravitybrew.com. Now, this was a fun conversation. Kim Bender of the Heirich House Museum in Washington, D.C., approached Sam Fitz of Ancho Cidery to revive this Prohibition-era cider brewed by Christian Heirich's brewery. It's a fun story, and in this interview, we also learn of Ancho's vision of making no-adjunct, single-variety ciders in traditional ways, and we also get the straight scoop on Johnny Appleseed. Well, Kim Bender, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you for having me.
And Sam Fitz, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks.
We are on a three-way Skype call, so as I said before, I'm crossing my fingers and knocking wood that everything is going all right, and everything keeps going all right. But I want to get some background on y'all in the beginning in your organizations, and then before we dive into the details. So Kim, talk about Heirich House Museum and sort of the history of your organization.
So actually, although you're pronouncing the name correctly in the way a German person would say it, it was changed during World War One or around World War One to be pronounced Heirich because of anti-German sentiment and trying to make it a little bit more Americanized. So, you know, as many people change their names and they sort of blend in more to American culture, became Heirich. So Christian Heirich was DC's largest, I like to say most successful, historic brewer. And his brewery operated from about 1872 until 1956. Christian Heirich himself, was a German immigrant who lived until 1945, and he died when he was 102, was still brewing, was the, we think, the oldest brewer. And his brewery was a household name in Washington, D.C. Everyone would have, you know, it would have been something you just get at your local store, at your local bar. And today we operate his historic home as a museum. It's intact almost exactly as it was when his widow died in 1956. We have all the furnishings and everything. We have a lot of their papers, photographs. And so we tell the story of essentially the story of the American dream through his story. And we actively try to work with the community, to work with small local manufacturers to try to help them succeed with their American dreams. That's what we're all about here. And the museum is in DuPont Circle in Washington.
And so I'm assuming that the brewery doesn't exist anymore. Does the building exist?
The building was knocked down to make way for the Kennedy Center. So if you go sit outside at the new Reach at the Kennedy Center, you're basically sitting where the brewery was.
Ah. So I take it that that Heirich was important in the history of brewing in this country.
I think, you know, he came here with a wave of German immigrants who brought their lager beer with them and changed the palate of American beer drinking. And he really did do that specifically in Washington. He took over a failing wheat beer brewery, actually just down the street from where the mansion is today, and converted it into a lager brewery. And it took off. And he was very good at marketing, very good at getting out there, making relationships and getting it in hotels and in bars that, you know, in a wider range of bars in the city. And so I think he was important in that he reflected what was happening across the country in lots of different cities with German American immigrants and how they brought their culture to America. And then in DC, he was important because, you know, he was this household name for over 85 years in DC. And so really, like, if we look at the way his brewery changed, if we look at his marketing materials, we can see snapshots of the city and the history of the city through what he was doing here.
Wow. And Sam, let's see if I'm more successful at pronouncing your... I start off with a bang right here. You are with Ancho Cidery. Is that correct?
That is, yeah.
All right. So talk about Ancho. Who are y'all and where'd you come from?
We are D.C.'s first... we are the first licensed winery in D.C. since Prohibition. As a cidery, we operate legally as a winery, though we only use apples in our production. So we're essentially making wine from apples here in the district. We source the majority of our apples from Virginia and Pennsylvania, so local to us, although we do get apples from Vermont and Washington State and England and a few other places. My background was in beer. That's actually how I met Kim, just kind of being in similar social and work circles. And after 10 years of working with beer, I got really interested in cider and what it could be. So we founded Ancho. Everything we make is apples only, and everything we make is sugar free. So that means that all of our different products really vary based on the apples that we use predominantly, which is pretty different than a lot of our competitors. And I think that's a good place to start, especially considering Tim's a little low on time and my daughter is screaming in the background.
Yeah, let's switch gears. We only have Kim for a short period of time. So Kim, talk about this project that you're working with Sam on.
So we, started doing revival projects. That's what we call them, revivals, pulling back historic brands and reintroducing them to Washington, D.C. And we started with Hyrix Lager, which was one of his flagship beers that we brewed with D.C. Brow. I think the first year we brewed it was, I want to say like 2016. And then we have also recreated Senate Beer, which is based on actual historic documentation, like multiple hundreds of pages of laboratory reports. Another flagship beer. And so Sam and I got in touch and he was like, do you have a cider that we could do? And actually Hyrick only has one cider that he ever made or attempted to make, I guess. he knew Prohibition was coming, and Prohibition came to Washington earlier than the rest of the country in 1917, actually on Halloween Eve in 1917. You can imagine the party. And so he bought, according to all of his autobiographies and things, he bought $100,000 worth of Stamen Winesap apples and tried to make, he pasteurized and sterilized kegs and all of his equipment and attempted to make a non-alcoholic hopped cider. Had it in the tanks and was selling it as non-alcoholic cider. And somewhere in there, by 2 years later, it had fermented. So that ended his ability to sell it legally, but somehow he was able to get sort of a dispensation for about 3 weeks over Christmas between 1920. And people could come bring their up to 5-gallon tank container, and people apparently were lined up around the street to come fill up with this, you know, one time you can grab some alcohol during Prohibition. And even like in their journals, they talk about how limos from the White House came to get it. So that's where the cider, that was what the cider was. And, you know, when I told Sam about the story, he seemed really excited about it. I'm sure he can tell you from his point of view. And when we pinpointed that it was Stamen Winesap apples, I think that was like it. That was what clinched it.
So $100,000 back then, that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. A lot of money to spend on apples. I think he saw it as like a way to pivot his business during something that was meant to put him out of business.
Mm-hmm.
He was in his 80s at that point. He was a fighter, and he had reinvented himself multiple times by that point. So I think he was going in it with a fight.
So were they able to survive Prohibition?
They were, but only really because he had invested, well, a couple of different things. He had invested a lot of the money that he made from the brewery into land. So he was also by that point a wealthy landowner and was making income off of that. So he wasn't destitute by not being able to brew. And he survived Prohibition. Like, he was alive when Prohibition ended, which is not true of a lot of his peers of his generation. So he opened the brewery back up again and restarted.
So what happened to the did they get to sell all of the cider?
No, they sold as much as they could in those 3 weeks. And when Prohibition ended, he was forced to dump it down the drain. They would not let him sell it. And there's this very sad image of him in a newspaper article just watching it go down the drain. So unfortunately, it's in the Potomac now.
But thanks to you and Ancho, it gets to live again.
I know, and it's delicious.
Spoiler alert. So is there any, I know you have to run, but is there anything else to the story or to this cooperation that that you want to add?
No, I think that's like the majority of the story. I just think it's always fascinating to me now that I understand how cider is made a little bit better, that he would have thought that it wouldn't ferment. I do think he thought it would not ferment. I don't think he was trying to be tricky. And, you know, people want him to have been a bootlegger. He was not a bootlegger. But I think it's fascinating that he did not even conceive that it could ferment.
So either he didn't do his pasteurization well enough, or it's some wild yeast or yeast from other parts of the process kind of sneaked in there, maybe.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, Sam could talk more about the process of fermentation, but I would think it would be inevitable, Sam.
Well, I don't, like, was he pasteurizing? I don't even know when pasteurization became a common thing in beer. Like, did he have that capability, Kim, for his normal products?
He said he did. In the articles, it says he pasteurized it, but I don't know what that actually means.
Yeah, you know. So it sounds like either the pasteurization process that he used for beer wasn't sufficient for cider, or as our host mentioned, you know, possibly contamination in the future allowed new organisms access to the sugar. But I think maybe, Kim, to your point, it's surprising that someone who is so worldly and so skilled and, like, you know, he seems to be like the brewing champion of the area. It's like surprising that would have caught him off guard.
Yeah.
But I guess the one thing I would say is that fructose and cider is just so much more fermentable than maltose and beer. And I have this experience with homebrewers all the time who, like, they don't understand that if you just leave apple juice out, it will ferment to terminal gravity, like, super easily. So it could just be his perspective.
Well, Kim, your time is up. it was good to meet you, and I appreciate your contribution, and good luck with the museum and with the cider.
Thank you, and have fun talking to Sam. I'm sure he's going to tell you some really fun stuff about it, too.
Yeah, it's just going to be fermentation nerds now, so. Thanks, Kim.
Thanks, Kim.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Now, that's a first on the show. That's a first that somebody's had to leave.
Well, sorry for the late start on that.
No problem. But like I said before, it's just us fermentation nerds here now. Now your audience is beer geeks and mead geeks and cider geek, you know. So you're in good company here now. So you can not be afraid to get technical with us. So talk about this. Is it called the Liberty Apple?
It is called Liberty Apple Cider, which, so I should give a caveat that the name and the label are a complete recreation that was done by Kim's team. So I know she just jumped off the call, but the label of the can is actually the same label from the original product. And so her team found record of that label and put the label together, and the name is the exact name that was used. So in terms of that, you know, Onso really had very little to do with it. We deferred to the museum for historical accuracy on that.
The original product was hopped, as Kim said, but this product does not, right?
Yeah, so that was the only thing that we couldn't do for the Heirich Museum. We have always been an apples only cidery, which means you know, casting no judgment on others. It's about what we want to do and what we want our brand to be. But our brand is strictly apples only. We've probably put 25 different ciders in can, maybe more, and every single one of them is only made from apples. So when Kim brought this project to me, I was very excited, but, you know, I told her from the start that we wouldn't be able to hop the cider. And in the end, she felt like that wasn't necessary in order to tell the story. You know, obviously, we're not shying away from the fact that the original product was hopped and this one is not. So it is, in that regard, that is the only, you know, differentiation or discrepancy between the original product and ours. But yeah, on Onso being apples only, we needed to stick to our core value.
Now, when you say apples only, does that mean no spices or flavorings or other adjuncts at all?
That is correct. We do not do any of that. No hops, no botanicals. We don't use peaches, cherries, literally nothing. If you look at every can, our ingredients say apples, yeast, and sometimes we use sulfites to preserve flavor.
Wow.
But we do not use any adjuncts. We're actually the largest cidery in the country that only uses apples for production. Every cidery that is larger than us has done so by offering adjunct ciders, which, again, I have nothing against, but it's our passion and our mission is to show people how amazing the apple can be when you focus your attention on it.
Yeah, so you really get to show off the character of each variety.
That's exactly right. And every can that we have lists the apple types that went into it. And, you know, our product is really, in a way, kind of out of place on the grocery market shelves. We're always in the cider section, which is appropriate. But you look at literally every one of our competitors, and they differentiate their products by what's added into it or the level of sweetness. So you might have a cidery that has a dry cider and a sweet cider, or you might have a cidery that has a you know, quote unquote, regular cider, and then a pear cider, then a cherry cider, then a hop cider. For us, every product is 0 grams of sugar. So literally dry. There's no sugar in any product that we make. And so you'll see our products on the shelf and you'll have 6 cans and it's all no sugar, apple only cider. And if you don't know the apples, then you really don't know what you're looking at. And for us, that's a good problem because once a consumer takes the dive and tries a product, we know they're going to like it, and then they become very curious about what the differences are. And then once they go through that process of sussing out the differences and what they like, they then can't find any other brand in the marketplace that operates the way that we do. Huh. And then we continuously put out new products like this Heirich cider that showcase, in this case, Stamen Winesap apples. But for people that follow our brand, we had never made a cider that featured Stamen Winesap before. So after making 25 ciders, we release a new cider that is using not a new apple. Stamen Winesap is hundreds of years old, but, you know, new to our consumer base. This is the flavor of a new apple and a new experience.
And talk about the character of that apple.
So to tie it to the project a little bit. So we're based here in D.C. I grew up in Baltimore, which is only, you know, 45 minutes northeast of here. And it wasn't until 5 years ago that I knew anything about apples. I used to be, I was the first certified Cicerone in DC. I did it in 2011. So I guess I could say I'm a beer expert. during my 10 years of being a Cicerone in DC, I never really extended any of that knowledge or interest into cider. I carried some cider at places I worked, but I was by no means knowledgeable. All of my apple and cider interest and knowledge is has only come to me in the last 5 years. And before that, I was very, I knew nothing about apples. I didn't know how they grew. I didn't, you know, I really did not know very much about apples at all. And outside of the apples that I might have gotten in a lunchbox or like, I guess everybody knows like Fuji or Gala or Honeycrisp, like I was aware of those names the way that someone who goes to a grocery store and sees the generic apples that are there is aware of them. But literally the only apple that I knew, the only real apple that I knew growing up was Stehman Winesap. And that's because every fall in Maryland, Stehman Winesap is an apple that becomes ripe in late September. It doesn't last incredibly long. And so when it comes off the trees, it's ready. And all of the farm stands near where I grew up, every September, they were just loaded with bushels and bushels and bushels of Stehman Winesap. And I remember every fall, I would go with my dad to buy this giant bushel of Stehman Winesap apples. And it was literally the only American heirloom apple that I had any relationship with. So when Kim told me that she had this project that she was interested in, I said, yeah, this sounds fun. We've had a great time working together. Like, you know, like, yeah, I'm in. We need to figure out what apples he used because that's really the only way that Anshul is going to contribute to this story. And so she said, all right, well, let me get my team to do our homework. And she came back to me and she said, all right, well, we know for sure that this cider was 100% Stehman Winesap. And that was just so funny to me because, you know, again, it's really the only apple that I've had a connection to my whole life. And Hyrex sourced those apples from Maryland. So, it all makes sense, you know, 100, or I guess it wasn't 100 years ago, 80 years ago, when a DC-based business needed apples. They looked locally and they found them in Maryland and they wound up with Stehman Winesap for the same reason that I was eating Stehman Winesap as a kid. Hmm. So I forget your original question, but there's my thoughts on Stehman Winesap.
What's the character of it?
Yeah. So Stehman Winesap as an eating apple has good acid and a lot of this is going to sound corny, but like just quintessential apple flavor. It's like a very apple-y apple. So from an eating perspective, it's sugary and fresh and apple-y. It has like a nice crisp, texture to it. But from a cider making perspective, for me, from Anshul's perspective, it's a pretty low tannin apple. And so I guess maybe for your fermentation geeks to kind of take a step back, when we talk about apples and cider, we're usually talking about acid, sugar, and tannin. Acid is fairly obvious to people, so something might be high or low acid. Beer geeks like sour beers, so like ciders that are really high acid start to get, you know, kind of into the sour beer range. So you've got acidity, you also have sweetness, which seems obvious, although I would like to point out that every cider I make is 0 grams of sugar, but they have different degrees of perceived sweetness. So I think probably the most amazing thing flavor wise about the ciders I make is that none of them have any sugar in them, but all of them taste off dry. Huh. I do have a couple of products that are deliberately meant to taste dry, but our 0 grams, no sugar, sugar-free, as dry as you can be scientifically, ciders usually taste off dry to people and have enough perceived sweetness in them that people like them. So for Anshul cider, I talk about acidity, perceived sweetness, and then tannin. Tannin is the place where I just lose people, whether they're beer people. Like, as soon as I start talking about tannin, people are just like, I don't understand what you're talking about.
it's the wine world.
It is the wine world. I mean, proper cider is wine. Tannin is the immune system of an apple tree. So when you cut the bark of an apple tree and it scabs over, or if you see apples themselves that have had like an insect bite into them and then they scab over like where the insect had like taken a bite, that's all part of the tree's immune system, not a whole lot different than our immune system. And tannin, I'm not an expert in the science behind this, but tannin is part of the tree's immune system. The way that I like to look at it in cider though, is it actually becomes part of the cider's immune system. So high tannin apples, there's a flavor component to tannin. Tannin is can sometimes be perceived as like maybe a little bit astringent sometimes, but it builds a lot of body. I think if you think of a big red wine, you can think about how tannin can like impart positive character into a liquid. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that tannin does is it helps preserve the liquid. And in that sense, it's essentially the immune system of the liquid. So if you make a cider or a wine that has a lot of tannin, it is going to be able to fight off infection, and it's going to be a lot less likely to be affected by outside influences. Conversely, if you have a product that's low tannin, it's going to be a lot more likely to be, this isn't necessarily about infection or not, but it's a lot more likely to change or to be influenced by other organisms. And I bring this up because Stamen wine sap is a low tannin apple. In my cider making world, it's one of the lowest tannin apples that I come across. And what that means is that it is more susceptible to outside influences. And sorry, this is all a long way of getting to the point, which is that we do make ciders in stainless tanks where we pitch yeast, and our flagship products are all made that way. So we'll put juice in a stainless tank and we'll pitch wine yeast in, and we'll have a very controlled fermentation with one yeast strain. That's one way that we make cider. The other way that we make cider, and the way that we made this cider, is in giant wood vessels. So we have, in our company, we have 500 to 700 gallon casks. People like to call them fooders, but they're not upright. They are technically just a cask. They're barrel shaped, but they are gigantic. And we use those casks to put really high quality juice into, and we do not pitch yeast into those casks. And so those fermentations are done. The fermentation is conducted by the yeast and bacteria that was on the skins of the apple. So you have an apple in an orchard and you have yeast and bacteria on the apple. You rinse the apple with water, but that doesn't take all the yeast and bacteria out of it. And then you press that apple into juice, and all the yeast and bacteria that was on the skin of the apple gets into the juice. And then if you pitch a commercial yeast into it, that commercial yeast is going to outcompete everything. And that's what we usually do. We don't pasteurize. We just allow the pitched yeast to overtake all the natural stuff. But if we don't pitch yeast, which is what we do in these wood barrels, then the fermentation is conducted by thousands and thousands of microorganisms. The more prominent ones we're familiar with. And then obviously there's thousands. So there's all kinds of stuff that we, you know, won't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And we make a lot of ciders in this way. And the really fascinating thing is that if we put apple juice that is high in tannin into those casks, the resulting product is not funky. It's not sour. It seems to be immune to all of the various outliers. The liquid is able to fight off what is technically an infection, right? So when we use like really traditional cider apples that are super high in tannin, we're able to put juice in there and have the end result be a product that I can take to a wine sommelier and blow their minds with. I can take a product to them and say, I know that you think wine is better than cider, but try this. And they'll what in the world am I drinking? Because it's really that good. You can make ciders that can rival the best wines with these really high tannin apples. So that's one thing that we do. Stamen wine sap is really low tannin. So when we put that into our casks, it allows all of the outliers to contribute a lot more. And that means lactobacillus and Brettanomyces and things that are probably more familiar to like the wild beer fan. Mm-hmm. And when those organisms strike up, we get a lot of funk and we even get a little bit of volatile acidity. We at Ancho like to sort out the difference between volatile acidity and acetic acid. So acetic acid is made by Acetobacter. That is the organism that makes vinegar. And we don't have any ciders that have Acetobacter in them. We make sure that we have no Acetobacter. So none of our ciders taste like vinegar. None of our ciders smell like vinegar. But when they get really high volatile acidity, which is what happens when we have low tannin, they get this like super high acid, piercing fruit note, which is what the Liberty cider has. And for people that like sour beer or wild ales, like this, these ciders really hit the mark for them. And so we're able to play this game with this lever with these casks where, you know, high tannin, we get like a high-end cuvee. Low tannin, we get like a funky everyday crusher.
I wonder if when Heirich was adding hops into the cider, I wonder if part of that was to be sort of as a preservative, you know, in order to help the cider not get funky or not start to ferment.
You know, I think that was probably part of the idea, although it's worth pointing out that cider production doesn't have any heat application. And so you know, I don't think dry hopping was all that big a thing in Heirich's time. So it sounds, I'm guessing that he probably, I mean, I'm not guessing, he would have been essentially dry hopping and probably didn't have much experience dry hopping. So he probably didn't realize that without the application of heat, the hops aren't imparting as much of a preservative power.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk about your process. Do you, in the back of the cidery, do apples come in, whole apples?
No, so we're an urban cidery. We have three locations spread out through D.C. We operate in small urban spaces. Bringing apples into the city, pressing them here, and then taking all the pomace out is really just not practical in any way. I mean, the process of bringing in and out is there's a lot of diesel and it's not cost effective. But also, you know, we pay D.C. rent and warehouse space is very minimal. So we just, when we were forming our cidery, we decided that it was going to be about the apples and that we need to know who grew the apples, where they came from. We need to know that the people that are growing them with care, with an eye towards cider production and not fresh fruit, because fresh fruit is picked early so that, and unripe so that it can sit in a cooler for 8 months before it goes to Whole Foods. Cider fruit you want to pick when it is like absolutely perfectly ripe. So the same apple can be better for cider if you let it hang. So we realized very quickly that it was super important to know what our apples were, where they come from, and all that. We decided in the end that the actual act of pressing does not have as much impact on the quality of cider as the selection of apples and how they're grown. So if you pick the right apples and you know the apples you're getting, who and where they're pressed really doesn't have a lot of outcome on the quality of the cider. We also realized that, so taking a step back, one thing that makes us really different than our competitors is that we buy every apple directly from the human being that grew it. So most of our competitors at our price point buy apples as a commodity. So they say, hey, I want 5,500 gallons of apple juice delivered to me. I don't care where the apples were grown. I don't care what type of apples they were. I just need them to have this sugar content and this acidity. And they'll even make acid adjustments. You know, if something comes in with the wrong acidity, they'll just dump, you know, malic acid into it to make an adjustment, which we also do not do. So because we buy everything as an apple directly from a farmer, we have a lot stronger connection with the people that grow our apples. And the truth of the matter is that the American apple farmer is just trying to hold on to their land and their legacy and their business. It's not an industry that people are like very avidly going into. There's not a lot of opportunity to make money. In fact, there's an opportunity to lose a lot of money. So most of the people that are growing our apples are people who inherited land and apples from their family, and they're looking at a modern market where apples come from Chile and New Zealand and China. And, you know, there's the American apple farmer is getting pushed out of the American apple market every day more and more. And so we realized that if we were going to be building a cidery that was based on buying apples from people who care about the apples, we need those people to be able to survive at their profession, or else we're just going to find a future where there's nothing but commodity apples. And so when we were looking at this, we realized that our farmers really make very little money off apples. Even when they're selling us a lot of apples, it is a tough business. And the value-added opportunities are where the opportunity is. We're a value-added business. I'm taking apples, which are a really hard thing to make money off of, and I'm turning them into cider and alcohol, which is an easier thing to make money out of. And the business of pressing apples is one of the value-added processes. And if we took that out of the communities that grew our apples, I don't know that they'd be able to keep growing apples. Mm. So by pressing where the apples are grown, we save diesel, we save transportation expense, and we save rent expense. But most importantly, we're paying the people that grew the apples to press the apples, and they make more money off the pressing than they do off the growing. Mm. And that's kind of how we work, why we work the way that we do. So if you just sat outside of Ancho for a month and just took notes on the way that we operate, you would see a giant generic tanker truck show up to our cidery once a week and pump a bunch of juice into our tanks. And that looks exactly the same as all of our other competitors who are getting a giant tanker truck of juice that pumps into the tanks. But the difference is the liquid in my tanker every single apple that made that liquid, I picked. And I determined when it was going to be pulled out of storage, when it was going to be pressed, and when it was going to be delivered. And that's a huge difference, even though the truck that delivers it is the same truck.
Well, it sounds like in talking about your process, it sounds like that's most of the process is selecting the apples, having, you know, determining when they're picked, determining when they're delivered. And then the rest of it, at least in some of these products, you just let Mother Nature take its course after that. So it's like, you know, whereas, you know, in the beer side of business, you know, a lot of the process happens in the brewery and, you know, you're actively choosing ingredients and you know, that whole process. But with your business structure, as I understand it, most of the work happens before it comes into the building.
Yeah, I mean, I brewing is done by people that are chefs for the most part. So if you're a brewer, you're a chef. And there are some exceptions, you know, like maybe like, say, lambics. But brewers and chefs are people that take ingredients and they amass them into something that is a reflection of themselves. And this is not meant to be a negative thing. I think this is a beautiful thing. This is a creator. This is a creative person. This is an artist, right? So whether you're brewing or cooking, you're taking stuff from the natural world and you're saying, like, I, Sam, I am going to create this thing, and this thing that I'm going to create is going to be a reflection of me. So if you enjoy this thing, you're enjoying my skill, my expertise, my vision, right? And in that regard, a brewer really is a chef, and there is a lot to celebrate there, right? Like, that's an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. That's not what I am, and that's not what a cider maker or a winemaker is. A cider maker or a winemaker is a steward of nature. We're not creating things. We're allowing nature to show itself. So I do some things that control the outcome. I decide whether I pitch yeast or not. I decide whether I want to put in a stainless tank or a metal tank. And I use temperature to control the fermentation. And that last part is so important. So I do pull some levers. I really have three levers I can pull. Well, actually, if you add tannin in, I have a fourth lever. But I do have some levers that I can pull. But at the end of the day, my job is to look at things that nature can make itself and allow it to be recreated like in the image of nature and not in the image of myself. And so sometimes when talking with the beer world, like, I don't brew cider. Brewing in its most basic definition involves the application of heat. So homebrewers, you know, they have a hard time wrapping their mind around cider because they want to apply all of this knowledge that they have from a practice that just doesn't exist in cider. I don't have a kettle, don't have a burner. We don't ever use heat. We don't brew anything. We just skip that step entirely because nature prepares fructose for you fully. It doesn't prepare maltose for you. You have maltose, you have to do work in order to make it ready. Nature has already made the fructose ready for you.
Well, let's talk about homebrewers. It is, I believe, and depending on where you live, it may be difficult to get unpasteurized cider. And so what, you know, that's kind of a conundrum unless you live next door to an orchard and you and you know a guy with a press, you know. Give some tips to homebrewers. How can they do, or how can we do, what you're doing?
My first tip to homebrewers would be to take a step back and look at apples. I get requests from homebrewers in June. They're like, hey, I'm thinking about making a cider. Can I get some juice from you? And I'm like, dude, it's June. Like, like, look around. Are there apples? Like, go to the grocery store. Your apples will say New Zealand, Chile, China. You know, like, apples are little babies right now on trees. Like, I know that COVID's going on right now and we're all stuck at home looking for, you know, projects, but it's June. Apples aren't ready right now. You know, it's like, this is a basic thing. Like, if you want to make really good cider, don't go looking for unpasteurized juice in June. You know, so my first advice would be to, like, if you're a good home brewer and you want to make cider, there's no point in making bad cider. You're already home brewing, and there's already, you know, how many beer styles can you make? Like, you know, thousands, you know? So if you're going to venture into cider, you might as well make good cider. And if you're going to make good cider, just make it when apples are in season. So that will make your life a lot easier. And, you know, depending on where you live, you're in Arkansas, like that, I would imagine, I don't know if you're rural or not, but I would imagine in season, there are apple orchards where you can go get apples, you know?
There's a sad story there, but Northwest Arkansas used to be the center of apple production in the country years and years ago. But mm-hmm. now there's like one orchard in Washington County.
Yeah, like the one family orchard that survived. North Carolina is the same way. Yeah. So, you know, I would say for homebrewers, I would say revere the apple. Find a source of unpasteurized juice in season. What we do in DC, because I get these tanker trucks of extremely high quality unpasteurized juice, we get them every 1 to 2 weeks from September through February, and we allow homebrewers to buy juice right off the truck.
Oh, wow.
So if you leave me with we ask that you leave a sanitized carboy with us, and when we're unloading the truck, we will fill your carboy, and then you can come pick it up later that day. And through that program, someone living in DC will get access to probably over a dozen different types of apples over the course of the season.
Wow.
You know? So, you know, that would be my advice. I will say, I know that a lot of homebrewers are very interested in adjunct ciders, and I have nothing against them. So my advice is for making, I struggle for a word that doesn't make it sound like it's better than other things, like proper cider or whatever. But my advice is for people that want to make wine out of apples. If you want to take your chef mentality to cider and make hop cider or peach cider, you can do that with all the same energy that you do with beer. You know,
is it possible to make a good cider out of a pasteurized product?
I mean, if
that was a long pause.
my pause is because most things that are already pasteurized never had good apples in the first place.
Mm.
So, like, if you're asking me if you can go out and buy pasteurized juice and make good cider, the answer is probably no, not because it was pasteurized, but because the apples that went into it were of low quality. If you have really high quality juice that you pasteurize, you're not going to get a natural fermentation, but you certainly can make an amazing cider with wine yeast,
right?
You know? But again, it would be, if you're getting great juice, the issue is getting good juice, not pasteurization or not.
Right. And I would assume that most of the, I mean, they say that Johnny Appleseed, you know, when he was planting apples, you know, orchards across the country, they weren't for eating, they were for cider making. You know, and I'm assuming that a lot of the apple varieties that are really good and delicious as far as table apples may not have the balance of those tannins and the sugars and that you're talking about. Is that accurate?
Well, I mean, both, you know, people say that Prohibition killed cider and that apple trees were cut down by, you know, religious zealots who thought that they would produce alcohol. And you mentioned the Johnny Appleseed story. Like, as with anything, these stories are, you know, they're as untrue as they are true. And I really don't really put much credence if you want to know what Johnny Appleseed was doing and why it wasn't Prohibition that killed cider, I can try to make this short. Johnny Appleseed was not planting cider apple trees. He was planting apple trees. So are you familiar with grafting? Do you know what the process of grafting is?
Yes.
So every orchard, every apple tree that anybody has ever seen commercially grown anywhere is a combination of two trees. There is a tree in the ground that determines how big the tree will be, and then there is another tree grafted onto it. They're Franken trees, like Frankenstein. It's like literally two things connected to each other. So again, the bottom tree determines the size and the top tree determines the fruit. The reason you do this is because apples are like human beings. If apples or human beings make another organism, it will be unique. Right. So like two human beings have a child. There's no situation where the child comes out as an identical twin of the man or the woman. Right. Apples work the same way. If you have a Macintosh apple and you want more Macintosh apples, you can't plant Macintosh seeds. The seed will be a new apple that's the result of a Macintosh and whatever pollinated it. So I bring this up because Johnny Appleseed was planting apple seeds. He was not planting grafted trees. So every single seed that Johnny Appleseed put in the ground, every single one, which was millions, maybe billions, literally every single one was a unique tree that had never existed before in the world that he didn't know what it would be. So it could be an apple that was good for eating or cider or baking, or most likely it would be an apple that was useless for everything, because most new apples don't taste good. They don't keep well. They're not good for cider. The reason he was planting trees was because he was a businessman. If you wanted land in Ohio, the federal government would give it to you if you planted an orchard. And the reason that an orchard was the requirement is because an orchard won't bear for 5 to 10 years. So you are making a commitment to the land. You say to the federal government, I'm going to plant 100 apple trees, and I'm not going to get any fruit for 5 to 7 years, and I'm going to be out here in this frontier world where, you know, the First Nations who actually deserve this land are pissed at me because they should be pissed at me, and I might, you know, die because I'm committing treason on their land. And I don't know where my food source is going to be, and these apple trees aren't going to produce for 5 years. And so the federal government gives you land, right? So Johnny Appleseed was providing the means for people to acquire land from the federal government. He would go to a new plot of land, he would plant 100 apple trees, and he would say, pay me for these trees. You now own these trees. The government will now give you land. And that's how Ohio started. So to take this back to the love of the apple, though, you're a frontiersman, and Johnny Appleseed planted 100 trees, and he leaves, right? And if you're lucky enough to survive long enough for those trees to bear, you now have 100 unique apple trees. Every tree in your orchard is a tree that has never existed in the world. And so you're going to go through that orchard with your family, and 97 of those 100 trees are going to be useless, right? They don't taste good. They don't bear right. They're weird. But one of those trees, your daughter just eats every single one, and it just tastes better than any apple you've ever had. And one of those trees makes alcoholic cider that allows you to survive the winter of a flavor that you've never had. And one of those trees, when you bake the apples, it makes the best pie. So you've got one of each of these trees, and then you have 97 bad trees. So then you go back to the other 97, and you cut them down to the ground, and you graft the twigs from the other three trees onto it. And then 2 years later, you have 33 baking trees, 33 eating trees, and 33 cider trees. And that is how the apples that are American apples were created, all of them. Before universities started creating Honeycrisp and stuff, stuff like Stamen wine sap, all of these trees were chance seedlings that some human being said, this is better than those for this reason, and so I'm going to graft them. And that is how all of our American apples, before the modern ones, came to be. So yeah, that is the story of Johnny Appleseed.
I like your story better. Yours is a better story.
It is. I don't know why people don't tell it. But then the other thing is that it's tied to Prohibition too. So people say that Prohibition killed cider. It's not Prohibition that killed cider. It was universities and businessmen and programs that realized that they could create designer apples. Not apples that frontiers people just picked out as being better than other, but things that were, you know, are grown in lots of 10,000, you know, to find the perfect tree. But these apples in the modern, sorry, taking a step back, the frontiersmen wanted apples that could be used for a lot of things. They wanted apples that you could eat or bake or make cider out of. I call those American heirloom apples, and Stamen wine sap is one of those. A Stamen wine sap tastes good to eat. It makes good cider, and you can bake with it. Modern apples like Honeycrisp, they're bred only for sugar and storability. That's it. They don't care about aspartame. It's just how much sugar is in it and how well does it store. So our modern apples now, they're the real Franken apples. They're not real apples. They're not created by nature. Honeycrisp, Gala, Mac, Fuji, these are like bastardizations of what the natural world could do. And the reason that people cut down Stamen wine sap and Albemarle Pippin and Kingston Black and Ashmead's Kernel, all these great American apples, the reason they cut them down is because they realized they could make more money selling a crap commodity like Honeycrisp. It had nothing to do with Prohibition. It had to do with capitalism and the marketplace changing. And so all these stories that we tell about apples and cider, there's just almost no truth to them.
How can people get a hold of the Liberty Apple Cider?
So in DC, you can get it through us or through Hyrick. But we also, we have, I think, 200 or 300 accounts in DC. We wholesale throughout the whole city. So you can get the Hyrick cider all over DC. If you are outside of DC, we ship to 40 states. I can't name all 40 off the top of my head, but we ship to all but 10 states that don't allow shipping. So if you may have noticed that we have two different websites. We have anchodc.com and we have anchocider.com. Anchodc.com is catered towards locals who have access to our brick and mortars. Anchocider.com is catered towards non-Washingtonians. If you go to anchocider.com, you can order the Hyrick Liberty Cider delivered to your door in 40 states.
There you go. Well, Sam, I have a feeling we could talk for another hour, but I appreciate your time, and I've wanted to go out to D.C. for various reasons. There are a lot of good homebrewers out there, and now I have another reason. I appreciate it.
Yeah, come see us.
Thanks,
sir. We're kind of the home for homebrewers in the area that are interested in cider, so yeah, come see us.
Well, thanks again to Kim and Sam. You can find Hyrick House Museum at hyrickhouse.org. That's H-E-U-R-I-C-H house.org. And anchocider.com. That's A-N-X-O cider.com. I'm spelling URLs left and right today. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. It's all until next time. Till then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production up for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.